Welcome, everybody. Thank you for tuning in. I think it's obvious that there really is only one story to talk about this week. 2020 has not failed to provide us with more historic events to cover. It's only appropriate to start this story with the murder of George Floyd. I find it hard to believe that you haven't seen it already, but if you haven't, we recently saw a clip that surfaced of a white police officer in Minneapolis forcing his knee down on a black man's neck for 8 minutes and 46 seconds while the life was squeezed out of him. It was truly horrifying to watch George Floyd cry out for his mother and plead for his life with Eric Garner's infamous final words, "I can't breathe." And what crime did this cop deem severe enough to use inhumane and ultimately lethal force? Passing on a forged bill. Ridiculous. The onlookers begged the officer to stop pushing down, but he kept his knee there even after George appeared to lose consciousness and his pulse. The white cop clearly did not value his life. He treated him like an animal. Quite simply, this was a murder. George Floyd was lynched. This was a visceral image that symbolized the long, arduous, and painful dehumanization of black people that has existed in America since its inception. The killing set off a wave of civil unrest and Black Lives Matter demonstrations. The first night in Minneapolis was marked by large crowds and some rioting, looting, and arson as the police precinct and some other buildings were set on fire. Afterward, the protests, the vast majority of which were peaceful, spread like wildfire. We've now seen demonstrations in all 50 states and even other countries, including France, the Netherlands, England, Australia, and Germany. It truly is staggering to see the crowd sizes of people in America and other white majority nations who are finally standing together with the black community to oppose this perpetual injustice that they have to live with. It's important to remember also that all this is happening in the midst of a pandemic. I don't want that to go unnoticed. There is an increased health risk with all these crowds in the streets. And it certainly is ironic given all the outrage that was out there around the lockdown protesters from a couple of weeks ago. I certainly hope that this complete flip in our attitude towards coronavirus and its spread doesn't go unnoticed. We should still be cautious, wearing masks, and doing our best to social distance where we can. Now, I'm definitely proud of the outpouring of support and how seriously this movement is taking itself. But it's important to ask, what ends are we striving for? What actions are we demanding? First and foremost, we want justice for George Floyd and all of the other black victims like him. I want to commend the protesters in Minneapolis for making a very clear list of grievances and demands, asking for specific charges to be brought against George Floyd's murderer. And this was undoubtedly a pressure that helped prosecutor Keith Ellison bring up the charge to second-degree murder and to bring forward charges against the other officers. These protests specifically are an example that we should follow. We also want policy and policing reform. A number of other campaigns have become prominent, like #8CantWait by Campaign Zero, which is calling for 8 specific reforms that provably reduce violence and murder in policing. And I'm also very proud of the local work that's being done in New York, for example, which has been focused on measures like repealing 50A, which is a law that protects police secrecy. And actually, that pressure worked as well, because that measure has recently passed state Senate and House. And it seems that the Minneapolis City Council is set to, in their words, disband the police department in favor of a new model of public safety. We have started this new conversation. We haven't really seen a national leader emerge, but I was happy when Al Sharpton announced a march on Washington that is being scheduled for August 28th, 57 years to the day after MLK's famous I Have a Dream speech. We too will have a chance to stand up for justice and send a message to those in power.
We have specific policies that need to happen. Therefore, I'm glad Martin III is here today, because on August 28th, the 57th anniversary of the March on Washington, we're going back to Washington, Martin. That's where your father stood in the shadows of the Lincoln Memorial and said, I have a dream. Well, we're going back this August 28th to restore and recommit that dream, to stand up, because just like at one era we had to fight slavery, another era we had to fight Jim Crow, another era we dealt with voting rights, this is the era to deal with policing and criminal justice. We need to go back to Washington and stand up, black, white, Latino, Arab, in the shadows of Lincoln, and tell them, this is the time to stop this.
I'm hoping that this march will be tied to specific policy demands at the federal level, and that we use it as an opportunity to build momentum for our new vision for America. Now, ultimately, this movement is still amorphous, but I am hoping that we all remain united and focused on demands. We have to be clear about what we want and make sure these protests aren't just a public display of outrage, like so many other protests during the Trump era have been. We also have to make sure that we don't only focus on police and criminal justice reform, so that we don't lose sight of the economic policies that would actually lift the black community and tackle the core rot that we have left in their neighborhoods. We need to focus on improving schooling, health services, and environmental infrastructure, and avoid creating more situations like the one in Flint, Michigan, where politicians chose to deliberately poison black families. For God's sakes, clean their water. We all need to be donating, calling, emailing, and rallying to continue to apply this pressure. It's working. And definitely take a look at my newsletter for this week's episode, where you'll find a few links where you can get involved. And most importantly, we need to be voting in our elections, not just the national fanfare every 4 years, but on the local level, so we have a say in how our police operate, who our DA and county prosecutors are, and about the standard for public safety and justice that we want to uphold locally. And besides all this, there is a much deeper demand that the black community has for all of us. Simply, it's self-reflection. What we all have to do is not only wrestle with our history, but wrestle with how we understand that history, and how little we have challenged our traditional social studies class narrative that leaves out real emotion, grief, dehumanization, politics, and systemic injustice. We have a long history of torturous slavery and racial oppression and discrimination, segregation and domestic anti-black terrorism, cultural devaluation and dehumanization, and a more recent history of mass incarceration, economic segregation, and whitewashing of the American story. A great writer, Caitlin Johnstone, eloquently described this moment as a head-on collision between the story America's political, media, and educational institutions tell Americans about what their country is and the reality of what their country actually is. Let's remember, white people from Europe literally came to this land, slaughtered, quote, red-skin natives, and looted the continent of Africa, bringing black people to this country as property. We had a bloody civil war where one side's soldiers died to protect the right of whites to keep their human property. Even after the abolition of slavery, we had a pervasive anti-black culture that purposely segregated blacks physically and culturally from whites who still deemed themselves superior. Groups like the KKK terrorized these communities, and people like Emmett Till were hung from trees because they, quote, thought they were as good as any white man. And we can't forget that he and thousands of others had no smartphone to document the atrocities committed to them. Despite major gains in the 60s, we started a drug war and created a system of mass incarceration that exacerbated our abuse of the 13th Amendment to essentially re-enslave the black population. Racist practices like redlining have segregated black neighborhoods and targeted public austerity and neglect of public infrastructure has pushed black families systemically behind everyone else on the track to gaining personal and generational wealth. The worst part is that we have convinced ourselves that our culture has confronted this history, because we got a black president, and we got an excuse to push down the expectation that we need to take action to change the horrifying status quo that still exists. Both Republican and Democratic politicians are complicit in keeping the systemic racism in place and have done nothing to bring forward our history so we can all reckon with it as a society together. Today we will need to face the anti-blackness that is ingrained in our Western culture and institutions and finally stamp it out. We also need to look at our own lives and recognize our individual place and our privilege. I myself, as a white person who grew up in the affluent suburbs of New York, have to reckon directly with why there were so few black kids in my school when I was growing up, and how I may have given in to subconscious bias or failed to stand up against it, and also how I may have failed to create an environment where the few black friends that I had the space to honestly bring forward their feelings and their experience. I have to hold myself and the people in my life accountable to the subconscious racial bias that we have been desensitized to. I have to challenge my perception of my own community as one which understands the plight of being black in America and see where I was misguided. We need to find real empathy and understanding and not just signal our virtue at this tragic event. We need to get closer to our black friends, learn about their experiences, and explore their culture. We need to watch documentaries, read books, and listen to black music to find a deeper understanding of the human experience through their eyes. To all my black brothers and sisters, we don't just see and hear you. We are standing up against this with you. Be patient with us, because it is hard to find the line between signaling and genuine action, and more often than not, we can only sympathize with your experiences because we just aren't black. But make no mistake, we are not just here to post black squares on Instagram and get hashtags trending. We are ready to work with you to change popular consciousness and demand specific systemic change that ensures your liberty to be black in America without fear. As I mentioned earlier, in the first few days of the protests, some areas saw rioting, looting, and arson. And though it was nowhere near a majority of the people, there was enough happening that shocked the sensibilities of many and elicited an aggressive response from city governments and Trump. The scenes have become steeped with irony as the protests, which are focused on ending police brutality, have been met with even more violence from the state and police. We have seen clips of cops beating protesters and journalists with riot shields and billy clubs, flagrant use of tear gas, rubber bullets, and flashbangs, which have caused serious injuries to quite a few demonstrators. There's also a clip of this nice elderly old man who is returning a helmet to the officers, who was aggressively shoved down to the ground for no reason and is now in critical condition. And I think probably the worst clip I've seen is the one of the NYPD driving their cars into a crowd of demonstrators. This was exactly the kind of tactic that we condemned when it was used in Charlottesville by neo-Nazis to try to kill people like Heather Heyer. Stunning hypocrisy there. Seemingly, this is all justified in the name of law and order. And as a response to looting, which was admittedly a serious issue in some places and affected small businesses as well as large ones. But the clashes have sparked a new debate over the measures that a state can and should take in order to quell violence and looting. I myself am of the belief that rioting and criminal activity does a disservice to the peaceful protesters. Violence to me is never the answer. Traditionally, it gives an excuse for the state to respond with force. And many police departments across the country, particularly in the big cities, have been quick to dole out that force, which I described earlier and that you've no doubt seen flooding your social media feeds. This situation, and particularly the focus of police to put the force on the press and on peaceful protesters has been a frightening reminder that our police don't see themselves as the protectors of our communities and our rights, but as part of a law enforcement institution that is separate from the citizenry who protect this amorphous concept of law and order and answer to anyone who is giving the orders at the top. We have also been able to see how militarized our police have become as a result of actions taken by both parties, as cops now show up in armored vehicles and riot gear as if they're prepared to crush an insurgency rather than to safeguard our freedoms. Now, of course, this was all made much worse by the clown Donald Trump, who ordered police to beat and tear gas peaceful protesters in front of the White House to clear out a path for him to walk across the street to a burned church. There, he staged his Christian fascist PR stunt photo shoot with him and his Bible. He then threatened to use the Insurrection Act to send the troops in to address the violence, which he attributed to far-left political groups like Antifa. This is a toxic mix of a police force that has otherized their own community and a brazen authoritarian that solidifies America's transformation into a police state that infringes upon people's First Amendment rights with violent force. Some conservatives may bring up the uses of the Insurrection Act in the past, which have been justified, like the order given by Eisenhower to bring in an airborne division to help integrate schools in Little Rock, Arkansas. In that case, troops were brought in to protect black students who faced direct threats from their white community members. But Donald Trump is a uniquely flagrant and dangerous character who can't be trusted with this kind of power. He certainly isn't a level-headed leader, and he has made it clear with his actions against the protesters in front of the White House that he is the most likely person to blur the line between criminals and peaceful demonstrators, and that he is willing to escalate violence and use military occupation tactics against his own citizens. His actions thus far have proved to be as destructive as his words, and we have to be very careful with the precedent that we set today. While these protests have been focused specifically on violence by police against black people, it has raised this important question around law enforcement during times of civil unrest, and we would be foolish to ignore the slippery slope we are on with regards to state-sponsored violent force, censorship, and oppression. The New York Times reportedly even approached Tom Cotton to write an op-ed entitled "Send in the Troops," which made this right-wing case for domestic mobilization of troops in a situation like this. But that was met with a backlash from staff and the woke Twitter army, and it was ultimately censored. Now, I understand the high stakes of this debate, but censoring these ideas is not the answer. We need to be ready to challenge arguments like this, which we see as authoritarian, without responding with our own authoritarian tactics. The moment we start shutting out voices we don't agree with, we are setting a precedent that will most certainly come back to hurt us in the future, especially those of us that are advocating for structural change and who are opposing powerful interests. There has also been a new movement to defund the police, it seems, which can appear to be similarly misguided. I wholeheartedly understand this idea and agree that it is absurd that some urban police departments like the ones in New York have been way overfunded. But we can't be so ham-handed with this argument. We have to be very clear about what defunding the police means and what new models of public safety actually entail in practice to make sure that those on the right cannot accuse us of endorsing lawlessness. I would definitely start by demilitarizing our police so that our communities don't resemble a war zone every time we need large-scale patrols. Author of The End of Policing, Alex Vitale, explains that really there is a deeper issue with our decision to use the police to solve too many community issues. What many are calling for is not getting rid of the police, but reallocating money to community-identified needs, like funding for schools and mental health services that lift the people in the community instead of criminalizing them.
This is about the decision by elected officials to turn our social problems over to police to manage. Failing schools, give it to the police. No mental health services, give it to the police. Mass homelessness, use the police to kick homeless people out of the subway, et cetera. And so this is about rethinking our public political priorities and expressing that through a budget process that tries to lift individuals and communities up instead of criminalizing them.
It seems very obvious to me that this is exactly what we need from our leaders, even at the national level. Invest in us and empower us instead of criminalizing and literally beating down our attempts to reclaim our democracy. Finally, I'd like to remind us all that in heated times like these, it can be easy to lose sight of the larger historical context of the moment. Though these protests are very much focused on Black Lives Matter and George Floyd, there's a deeper reaction from the public which is expressing its extreme distrust of the institutions and leaders that govern American society. We should acknowledge, too, that this is a generally fertile environment for protest. First, Donald Trump is in office, so we all have this symbol of authority that a majority of us very clearly and obviously oppose. Also, in the last decade since Occupy Wall Street, we have seen a slow growth of grassroots movements, which really heightened in the last 4 years with the emergence of the March for Our Lives, the climate movement, the Women's March, among others. People are willing to get into the streets. And coronavirus and the economic collapse have forced many people to stay at home, so suddenly more of the masses have time to reorganize. Everything is happening so quickly that it's easy to forget that the backdrop here is a global pandemic and economic conditions akin only to the Great Depression. The majority of Americans have had to sit at home for months, watching their federal government fail to put together a coherent and adequate response to the crisis and prioritize providing liquidity to financial markets and large, profitable corporations while leaving them out to dry. Many people are still recovering from the effects of the last recession, where they also were fleeced at the expense of the capitalist class and the global financial system. And of course, we are fresh off a Democratic primary cycle where the younger generation's agenda was crushed and spat on, and our choices in November again are more authoritarianism from Trump and the neocons, or an archaic relic who embodies the neoliberalism that blindly paved the way for Trump. It has never been more clear to the majority of Americans that their institutions do not work for them. Cornel West had a great appearance on Anderson Cooper's show in the midst of the first few days of the unrest, and he crystallized the situation very well.
How do we keep alive moral, spiritual standards, keep alive, stand in contact with the humanity of all of us across the board, but recognizing we're living in a moment of massive economic, capitalist, what is capitalist economy? Failure when it comes to delivering the needs. The nation state, failure to protect. Critical criminal justice system, failure to be fair, you see. And the only response we have is Samuel Beckett, my brother. Try again, fail again, fail better.
A population that had no say in the architecture of their social systems is finally saying they've had enough with what they have inherited. They are demanding that their voices are finally going to be heard and that their grievances are addressed. The Black Lives Matter movement is the perfect lens with which to see this dynamic. It is a microcosm of this outpouring of powerlessness. The black community in America has never had real justice. Again, like I said before, we have never atoned for the sin of slavery even after its abolition. Blacks were still treated as second-class citizens, the larger culture dehumanized and devalued them, and certain white sections of the country terrorized and murdered them with no accountability. It sounds a bit familiar to me, to be honest. Throughout this time, they barely had a say in how the system worked, and as a result, it marginalized and segregated them and beat them down. Slowly again, there was more black representation in governing institutions inside the system as the civil rights movement shifted consciousness. But even then, our society still produced an economy that forced most black Americans into an underclass, and systems like mass incarceration came into being to undo all of our perceived progress. Still to this day, very few leaders, black or white, actually have fought to address the systemic racial injustice. Structural change was and still is nearly impossible in the inside of our system.
Know what's sad about it though, brother? At the deepest level, it looks as if the system cannot reform itself. We've tried black faces in high places. Too often our black politicians, professional class, middle class, become too accommodated to the capitalist economy, too accommodated to the militarized nation state, too accommodated to the market-driven culture tied with celebrity status, power, fame, all of that superficial stuff that means so much to so many fellow citizens. And what happens? What happens is we got a neo-fascist gangster in the White House who really doesn't care for the most part. You got a neoliberal wing of the Democratic Party that is now in the driver's seat with the collapse of Brother Bernie, and they don't really know what to do because all they want is show more black faces, show more black faces. But oftentimes these black faces are losing legitimacy too, because the Black Lives Matter movement emerged under a black president, black attorney general, and black homeland security, and they couldn't deliver, you see?
This lack of representation is common to all of us. We are all waking up to that feeling of powerlessness that the black community has had to endure for centuries. No one is coming to save us. If we want our society to be run in a different way, we will have to take the initiative and engage in our democracy. And more often than not, as we've learned in the past few weeks, get in the streets to make our clear demands and sustain pressure on our institutions. We have learned that the veneer of civil society is very thin. We have entrusted the operation of our social systems to a small group of largely white men who have allowed private interests to loot the public coffers and erode our social fabric. We have failed to hold them accountable for so long that this thin fabric is now tearing at the seams. In a historic moment of devastation like this, one spark can flip a society like ours from order to chaos. And George Floyd's murder, in this case, was that spark. We will have to tread cautiously and courageously through the coming months, because it doesn't seem like our leaders want to repair that social fabric, but rather to uphold the status quo and preserve the capitalist economic system that created this mess. Chris Hedges, who has been through his fair share of domestic struggles as a war reporter, has a dire warning for all of us. He says, and I quote, "The longer the ruling elites refuse to address the root causes behind these protests, the more they loot the treasury to enrich themselves and their fellow oligarchs, the more they engage in futile and absurd efforts to deflect blame, the more unrest will spread. The last desperate resort by the oligarchs to save themselves will be to stoke the fires of racialized violence between disenfranchised whites and disenfranchised people of color. This, I fear, is the next chapter in this saga." Generally, I am hopeful. But I want us to heed Chris's warning, because this is only the beginning of this fight. I do believe that our collective consciousness can be focused on the emerging movement, so we can put up a fight against these oligarchs. But they will come in with divisive and violent tactics to protect themselves, and it will be up to us to have the backbone to keep standing up.